Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Kendall, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is How to Bring a Just Peace to the Holy Land. Professor Tom Maloney will be introducing our speaker. He is the director of the Barbara L. and Norman C. Tanner Center for Nonviolent Human Rights Advocacy and the chair of the Economics Department here at the U. Please join me in welcoming Professor Maloney.
Thank you very much. It is my privilege to welcome all of you to this Hinckley Forum featuring Phyllis Bennis. This forum is part of a four-week series entitled Pathways to Peace. The purpose of this series is to reflect on currents of potential change in persistent conflicts and long-term policies related to war, peace, and security, including changes in the Middle East and changes in the focus and implementation of U.S. military policy. Next week, we will host our final speaker, Jamila Raqib of the Albert Einstein Institution, who will speak here at the Hinckley Institute on Friday, April 12th, on nonviolent struggle, past use, and future potential. A full schedule of Pathways to Peace events can be found at the Tanner Human Rights Center website, and there are all of our guests are speaking at a variety of venues around town and around the county, so I encourage you to look into the full schedule. The Tanner Human Rights Center is just one collaborator in the development of this series, and I also want to recognize the hard work and financial support of our partners, Westminster College, the Utah Valley University Peace and Justice Studies Program, the School of Humanities and Social Science at Salt Lake Community College, the Middle East Center, the Religious Studies Program, and the Marriott Library here at the U, the Salt Lake Public Library, the Gandhi Alliance for Peace, Utahns for Just Peace in the Holy Land, the Wasatch Coalition for Peace and Justice, and Peaceful Uprising. And now, it's my pleasure to welcome this morning's speaker. Phyllis Bennis directs the new Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. She is also a fellow of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. She's been a writer, analyst, and activist on the Middle East and on UN issues for many years, and she served as an advisor to several top UN officials on Middle East and UN democratization issues. She's also the author of several books, most recently Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, A Primer. She's already given talks at Utah Valley University, downtown at the library, this morning at Salt Lake Community College, so we're very grateful for her stamina as well as her expertise. And her topic today is How to Bring a Just Peace to the Holy Land. Phyllis Bennis.
Well, thank you all for being here this afternoon. Thank you for being inside on this incredible day. I was ready to bag my whole speaking tour and go hiking. But you guys get to live with this all the time, which, really, you should be very, very grateful. Washington, not so much. And I especially want to thank the Hinckley Institute and the Tanner Center and all the other peace and justice groups and the other universities that have sponsored my trip here. It's been a great opportunity to meet an extraordinary mix of people in these last couple of days, 36 hours and counting so far, and I've been able to do, I think, five events so far, four, something like that. So it's been great. You know, I was struck by the title that we chose for the discussion today, and I'm hoping that we will have time for a real discussion, which talked about peace in the Holy Land. And I think that sometimes part of the problem is that we think of it solely from the vantage point of religion. And as we know, religion causes huge amounts of conflict. Religion in the world also provides great comfort to lots of people, but the clash of religions can lead to a lot of problems. I think that when we look at the Middle East, and particularly Israel-Palestine, certainly there are crucial religious aspects to that conflict. But we move at our peril, I'm afraid, if we look at it solely as a religious issue. This is a land with people who live there, and issues of interests and policy And fundamentally, what I think provides us with the best framework for resolving conflict there, international law and human rights. Because that means it's just like everywhere else. Yes, it's holy to some people. Other parts of the world are holy to other people. And that needs to be taken seriously and respected. But it doesn't mean, you know, as somebody once said, God doesn't write real estate contracts. That doesn't answer the challenge of what you do about land, about rights. And it seems to me that what you do is treat people as equals across the board. Israelis are equal to Palestinians, are equal to everybody else. And if you start from that vantage point, international law is the basis of a solution, equality is the overall goal for the region, and human rights is the fundamental. That's enough. We don't need new roadmaps. You know, I just read the news this morning, was pretty grim, hasn't been confirmed yet, but Haaretz, the very good Israeli daily paper, was reporting that the Palestinian Authority have just announced that they would, I mean, they haven't announced it publicly, but they've said to crucial sources, that they are agreeing they will not go to the International Criminal Court and try to use their new UN status, being that of a state, in order to make any political gains, that they want to give U.S. diplomacy a chance. And I read that and I thought, really? 21 years of failed diplomacy and you want to give it another chance? When you have this great opportunity that you never had before, never was Palestine identified as a state by the UN General Assembly as it was last fall. That was huge. Granted, it was a non-member state, but UN membership is, that's a different issue. It's something to struggle for, but it doesn't take away from the fact that they were identified officially in international law. The group that gets to say whether you're a state or not is the UN General Assembly. And the UN General Assembly, with an enormously lopsided vote, said, yes, you're a state. The only reason to do that is if you're going to take advantage of that position, that credential of statehood, to act like a state, which in this case could mean your first act is to sign on to the Rome Treaty. The Rome Treaty created the International Criminal Court back in 1995, and 100-some-odd countries have signed on and ratified it now. And it's been operating since 2002. So that's kind of amazing. What does that mean? Probably doesn't mean that there would be any backlog of jurisdiction. It probably means that the Palestinians couldn't bring Israel to court for violations of international law that they committed back in 2008 in Gaza, for instance. But it does mean that once they sign and ratify the treaty, it would be a reality that any future violations by Israel could be under the jurisdiction of the court. That's huge. That's huge. So here they are saying, we're not going to do that, we promise. We'll behave just like you want us to. And I'm thinking, what are they thinking? This diplomacy has not worked. We need to think about an entirely new policy for the United States. Because at the end of the day, you know, this isn't our decision about what the political solution ultimately looks like. I was talking with somebody earlier today about the debate over one state, two state. It's a long-standing debate, and it's a fascinating debate, and it's an important debate. Because there's a whole bunch of evidence that a two-state solution as it was once envisioned, all of the West Bank, all of Gaza, and all of East Jerusalem, is simply over. It's gone. It's just not an option anymore. There's other possibilities of what a two-state solution could look like. There's the possibility of one state, which is pretty much what exists now. But at the end of the day, that's not our call. You know, we're Americans. We're not Israelis, and we're not Palestinians. Well, some of you may be both of those things, but I'm not sure. I don't think so. I'm not. I'm a Jewish girl from California. I don't get to choose, you know. I don't get to say how people divide up their land. What I do get to say is what my government does with my tax dollars in my name, with or without my consent. That's where I come in. That's where all of you come in. Because at the end of the day, we're not talking chump change here. The U.S., as some of you probably know, is in the middle of a $30 billion grant to the Israeli military. Now, Israel is the 23rd wealthiest country in the world, according to the IMF. They're doing pretty well. Why we're giving them any aid at this moment of economic crisis in our country is a very legitimate question. It's a particularly legitimate question when the money all goes directly to the military, which, by the way, unlike every other country that gets any military aid, and you know Israel gets about 25% of our entire aid budget, but that aside, every other country that gets military aid, they have to use all that money here in this country to buy military goods, guns, bombs, bullets, whatever it is they want, we make it all, and they have to buy it all here. So the money, ultimately, our tax money, comes right back to U.S. military corporations who are, we might say, making a killing on the Israeli occupation, not to put too fine a point on it. But Israel is different. Israel only has to spend 75% of its money here. It gets to spend 25%, unlike any other country in the world, on its own military-industrial complex, which competes with ours. So we get to fund their war profiteers as well as ours. I mean, this it's really kind of a crazy situation. But when we come back to that money here, we're talking a huge amount of money. You know, it's one of those things, we talk about billions of dollars. $30 billion is not chump change. Even relative to the size of the U.S. economy, $30 billion is a big amount of money. And it's one of those things I can't, I mean, are any of you math majors? No, okay. Math majors may be able to do this, but I got to say, I can never envision a million anything, let alone a billion. And I remember a teacher I had in, I think it was second grade, came in one day and brought in this huge piece of graph paper. You know the kind with the little tiny squares? It's 10 squares to an inch. And she brought in this huge piece of paper that covered a whole wall, and she said, all right, you kids, I want you to look at this piece of paper because there are a million little squares. You're never in your life going to see a million anything, and I want you to know how big a million is because you're going to hear a lot about a million this, a million that, a million people, $1 million, and I want you to know how many is a million. And we all kind of stared at it, and, you know, we're second graders. What did we know? But I've remembered that since that time. A million is really a lot. A billion, you know the math. It's 1,000 times that. And that's what we're talking about, $30 billion. Now, there's a great website. I was just going to look at my notes. I meant to look at it, and, oh, I did. Good. I remembered. The last thing I always do before I go to another city, I look at the website aidtoisrael.org because it does a very convenient thing. You click on your state, and you can choose your state, your city, your county, or your congressional district, and you can find out exactly how much that group, that city or whatever, that entity is paying out of that $30 billion of military aid and what else they might have done with it. So it turns out that Utah, all of you live in Utah? Yes? You all are paying $187.3 million over these 10 years in military aid to Israel. Now, what could you have used that money for? Well, you could have paid for new housing for 2,275 people every year for 10 years, 3,110 people to get training for new green jobs every year for 10 years, 5,539 children in an early reading program every year for 10 years, or 151,700 people in this state could get health care every year for 10 years. What's going to make us safer? Think about that. So the question of U.S. military aid to Israel is not simply an abstract question, and it's not simply a military question. It's not even simply a human rights question. It's also a question of our rights here. I mean, did we vote to give Israel that kind of money? Actually, your representatives in Congress, they did. But we didn't, right? So, you know, this is a question of how our democracy works. So when we talk about changing the policy, changing the U.S. policy, because unlike this question of, you know, one state, two state, red state, blue state, who gets to choose, we don't get to choose that one. But we do get to choose, and we have an obligation to choose what kind of a policy our government has and to demand that we change our policy. The policy we have right now enables illegal actions, enables occupation, enables violations of international law, enables apartheid. And I use that term very carefully because Israeli apartheid is not the same as South African apartheid was. It's quite different. But what they have in common is that both systems violate international law. specifically the International Covenant for the Suppression of the Crime of Apartheid, which was passed in 1973. And what that document says, what that law makes illegal, is a situation where you have one territory with one government controlling two separate systems for two different groups of people, in which one group of people is privileged to the disadvantage of another group. So in South Africa, it was white South Africans were privileged to the disadvantage of black South Africans. In Israel and Palestine, Israel is, you could say it's really one state at the moment, an apartheid state, where there are two or more separate legal systems. So Israeli Jews have one set of rights. Israeli Palestinians, Israeli non-Jews, Muslims or Christians, have a lower level of rights. And Palestinians in the occupied territory, who are still controlled by the Israeli government, have a third separate legal system. And the Israeli settlers in the same territory as the Palestinians have the same rights as the Israeli Jews inside traditional, inside Green Line Israel. That's apartheid. And our funding makes it possible, right? So we have, I think, an obligation to demand a change in that policy. Not a change that says we want a policy that supports one state or that supports two states, but a policy that supports international law, equality, and human rights. If it's one state, fine. If it's two states, fine. But that means within both states and between both states. You can't have equality if one so-called state is the wealthiest country in the region per capita, the strongest military power, the only nuclear weapons state in the region. Sorry, I've been talking too much today. The only nuclear weapons state in the region, and that controls all of its own borders, all of its own entry and exit, all of its own exports and imports. And the other so-called state has no control of its own airspace, no control of its own coastal waters, no control of its borders, no control over who goes in and out, no control of imports and exports, isn't allowed an army for self-defense, but we'll call it a state and we'll say they're equal. That ain't gonna fly. That's not what we're talking about. So our job is to change the policy of our country, ending that $30 billion gift and changing the policies that protect Israeli officials in the United Nations from ever being held accountable for their violations of international law. Now, understanding what it means to change policy means we have to start with what the policy is, what's it based on. And in many ways, that hasn't changed nearly as much as we would think from looking at the shifts that have constantly gone on in the region. U.S. policy in the Middle East hasn't really changed all that much in terms of its goals since the beginning of the Cold War 50 years ago or more. The three goals have to do with Israel, with oil, and with strategic location for markets and for strategic positioning. Those are the same three goals. They rarely get away with all three of them. And frankly, at the moment, they're kind of losing in all three. Israel is more isolated than it's perhaps ever been. I'll get to that one in a minute. In terms of oil, the Gulf War was in Iraq was fought largely, not solely, for the other two parts of U.S. strategy, one part being oil, the other part being strategic positioning. The U.S. lost that war. The U.S., I don't mean that it lost the war in Iraq because we're not leaving behind a great democracy. That was never the goal. The goal was, among other things, to ensure that U.S. oil companies would be running Iraq's oil fields and controlling access to Iraq's oil, ensuring that there would be a post-war government in Baghdad that was not only dependent on the United States, but friendly to the United States, accountable to the United States, and willing to allow the United States to use Iraq as a jumping-off point to attack Iran, and a government that was not going to be friendly to Iran or other U.S. opponents in the region. Well, it failed on all sides. On the question of oil, certainly U.S. oil companies are active in the Iraqi oil fields, but they are competing, and they're not getting any privileged treatment. They are competing with the Italian and Dutch and British and Chinese and Russian and Chinese and Swiss and Chinese and Chinese and Chinese oil companies. That's the reality of Iraq today. You want to talk about a government that's accountable to the United States? Maliki basically has no friends in Washington. There's practically no one he can even talk to. He's much closer to the government in Tehran. The idea of allowing the U.S. to attack Iran from Iraq, forget it. The U.S. can't even get the government of Maliki to stop allowing the Iranians to use Iraqi airspace to ship arms to the regime in Syria. That's how far we are from the idea of why we went to war. And then there's the question of the ability of the U.S. to control what goes on in the region. This is what the Arab Spring has transformed, and it affects both Israel and the United States. So although there's differences all over the region, some are making great progress, others are in terrible shape, and we don't know how this is all going to play out. This is going to be over a matter of decades. What began as the, quote, Arab Spring, I think still is an incredibly positive development despite horrifying developments in places like Syria and still quite horrifying in Libya. But the possibilities are huge for the claiming of citizenship and rights, for human rights in countries that never had access to human rights because they had dictatorships, most of them backed by the United States, that said, we're going to do what we want because we have the backing of the U.S. financially and militarily, so we don't really care what our people think. One of the requirements the U.S. put down on those governments, on those dictatorships, was that they make nice to Israel. But suddenly, the U.S. doesn't have that clout anymore. So it can't tell the dictator in Cairo that Egypt is going to be Israel's best friend in the region. And what a surprise, Egypt is not Israel's best friend in the region anymore. Nor is Jordan, even where there hasn't been an Arab Spring, but where the king is trembling because there's murmurs. Things are happening on the ground. Things are changing. There may well be an Arab Spring in the next year or two in Jordan. I don't know what form it would take. Probably it would not be a call for the king to step down. The Jordanian king, unlike some of the others, is actually quite popular with his own population. That's certainly not true in some of the other places, in some of the Gulf countries. The Arab Spring in Bahrain that we hear very little about these days, because the U.S. doesn't want to talk about it because we keep the Fifth Fleet there. And interestingly, ironically, rather tragically from my vantage point, the opposition has said, we would let the Fifth Fleet stay. And I'm thinking, really? Come on, guys. Don't do that. Say that we would get rid of the Fifth Fleet. That it doesn't make us safer. It puts us at greater risk. Take your Fifth Fleet and go somewhere else. We don't want your Fifth Fleet. But no, this is an opposition that is really perfectly willing to keep the Fifth Fleet. But the U.S. doesn't trust it, so they're, you know, supporting both the king of Bahrain, the emir, and the Bahraini decision to ask Saudi troops, 15,000 of them, to come and put down the Arab Spring in Bahrain. So in the context of that, and around the rest of the world, the U.S. simply does not have the kind of power it once did. Our economy is barely recovering from a huge crisis. It's still tanking in terms of people's lives in this country. The effect of the cost of these wars, we're just finding out from the new Harvard study that just came out, that it's not going to be a $3 trillion war. Again, think about those numbers. Imagine how big a trillion is. You know, a trillion, you might as well say a gazillion for all that you can really envision what it means. But trust me, it's a lot. It's a huge amount of money. It's not going to be $3 trillion. It's going to be almost $6 trillion by the time we get finished with the medical bills of the soldiers who are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan with such grievous injuries, such horrifying injuries, both physical and mental. TBI, traumatic brain injury, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. The episodes of suicide. You all know the statistics that more active duty soldiers are now being killed by suicide than are being killed by the so-called enemy of these wars. Friendly fire, if you will, are killing them. This is something that our country is going to be paying for in lives, in hopes, in dreams, in families, and in dollars for generations. And in that context, the question of what it means to talk about a new solution for the Holy Land has to be put in a regional context and in the context of human rights and international law. And who has the right to say what the diplomacy should look like? It's taken as a matter of course in this country that, of course, we have the right to say the Palestinians can't go to the UN. They can't make that kind of a unilateral move. It's a funny description when the UN is the essence of multilateralism, right? You're talking 193 countries. But the U.S. calls it a unilateral move on the part of the Palestinians to get their recognition of statehood or to take the next step if they chose to join the International Criminal Court in the hope that it might serve as a dissuading factor against future war crimes to be committed by Israel. It's not to say it would, but it might. That can't be a bad thing. But the idea that the U.S. gets to control the diplomacy and call itself the honest broker. It's an honest broker in the sense of like a real estate broker. A real estate broker can be completely honest, but she works for one side. She doesn't work for both sides. You know, each side has their own honest broker. When you broker a deal, if you're selling a house, you find a real estate agent to sell your house. That agent is dealing with the real estate agent hired or arranged by the person who's buying the house, right? So you each have an honest broker. You don't have one honest broker. The U.S. is an honest broker in that sense, but as my friend Rashid Khalidi's new book on how the U.S. has not been an honest broker, he's on a speaking tour right now on the new book that just came out. I recommend it to you. It's a terrific read. This is the problem that we face. There is no basis in the world for why the U.S., other than the question of power, why does the U.S. get to call the shots in these negotiations, in this diplomacy? Because the diplomacy is rooted on the reality of this power disparity, this huge disparity of power, which leads to a huge disparity of justice in terms of who's at the two sides. The U.S. position is, if we can just get the two sides back to the table. Now they're even abandoning the call on the Israelis to stop building new settlements just as a confidence-building measure, as they call it, not because it's legally required, so the Palestinians will come back to the table. And while on his last trip to the region, President Obama said, okay, you don't have to stop building settlements, and we'll get you back to the table, and told the Palestinians, we wish that the Israelis would stop building settlements, but even if they don't, you still need to go back to the table. And, you know, and then the next step is neither side is going to get everything they want. Both sides are going to have to give up something. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, this is not a border dispute between, you know, Ecuador and Peru. Or, no, they don't. Yeah, Ecuador and Peru. Those two, I'm thinking of the map. You know, the U.S. and Mexico. It's actually a little closer to the U.S. and Mexico. But this is not a border dispute between two equal countries that are, you know, fighting over where the border marker should be. This is over a powerful violator of human rights and international law, an occupying power, sitting across the table from the occupied population. The occupying power has obligations that have nothing to do with what the occupied population does or doesn't do. Whether or not the Palestinians fight back, Palestinians could, as the occupied population, they have the right to resist. That includes military resistance to a military occupation. Now, that doesn't mean any military action by Palestinians is legal. Targeting civilians or firing rockets that can only be sort of pointed in the direction of something and not really targeted at a military target is not legal. Those are violations of international law, and they should be held accountable. But whatever they do or don't do does not change the obligations of Israel as an occupying power to do a number of things, one of which is to end the occupation, and in the meantime, to implement the Geneva Conventions, which means, for example, no collective punishment. You cannot attack Gaza wholesale because it's a punishment for what some violation was committed in Gaza. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but somebody might be held accountable for that, but you can't punish an entire population. That's Article 33 of the Geneva Conventions. Article 49 of the Geneva Conventions prohibits the transferring of any population of your country into the occupied territory. That means 650,000 Israeli Jews living in illegal settlements in the West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem are violating international law every morning simply by waking up and getting out of bed because their bed is built on in a settlement on expropriated land. So if we start not from the vantage point of this is holy land or holy people or chosen people or any of that, But start from the vantage point of international law and human rights that applies to everybody. It means everybody have rights. Israelis have rights. They have right to live in peace and freedom and free from fear. They shouldn't have to be afraid of rockets coming from Gaza. The people of Gaza should not have to not only be afraid, but should not have to face the rockets that are falling on Gaza and killing people in huge numbers. People have rights. Countries have obligations. And that's a big difference, I think. So this point that we have right now, that Israel is isolated, doesn't yet mean that Israel is changing its policies. This election in Israel last month was based on, not on different opinions on quote, the conflict, but on internal domestic and social and economic issues. So there was a lot of talk. You probably read about it in the press. It was very mainstream press that this new centrist party sort of exploded onto the scene in Israel and won the elections. You know, they didn't quite beat Netanyahu's coalition, but they came pretty close. That's great. It wasn't quite as much of a sweep of the right wing as it might have been. But this definition of it as a centrist party had nothing to do with its position on the conflict. It had everything to do with its position on economic and social issues inside Israel, particularly some questions about prices, and the most important was the question of whether or not the ultra-Orthodox would be subject to the draft. Now, I found this fascinating. The front page of the New York Times, the front page of the Washington Post, lead story on NPR, lead story on all these news agencies, the Israelis have just voted for a party that supports the ultra-Orthodox being subject to the draft. And I'm thinking, Israel's this little country of 6.5 million people across the world. Who's our most important ally? Britain? Canada? Do we have any idea who's subject to the draft in those countries? Do we care? Why do we care? I mean, I'm Jewish and I don't even care whether the ultra-Orthodox are drafted or not. I mean, really, this is some other country's army. I'm not really concerned who they draft. I'm concerned about what they do. But here we were as a country obsessing on, you know, who's going to be drafted or not drafted. And this new party that emerged with, you know, 19 new seats, fabulous, whatever, they say that the ultra-Orthodox should be drafted. Great. I'm all for equality, so I guess they should be drafted. But frankly, if they commit the same war crimes as others in the Israeli army, it's not going to make anything any better, so I don't really care. But the problem is we have to get beyond that. Our concern should not be who's drafted and not drafted. That's an issue for Israelis to figure out for themselves. Might be fair, it might not. We've got enough problems of unfairness in our country. We don't have to worry about that. What we have to worry about is where's our money going? And who's being held accountable? So as long as there's no accountability in a court of law, as long as the International Criminal Court isn't allowed to hear a case of Israeli war crimes, for instance, to determine whether or not it was a war crime, because the U.S. protects Israeli officials from being held accountable, the accountability that happens will be the, quote, informal accountability of people around the world being so angry at Israel, Israel's policies, and those who enable Israel's policies, like us, that they will hold us accountable. So if you look back to the assault on Gaza, for example, last November, or the much longer 22-day assault, the war, what was known as Operation Cast Lead in Gaza in 2008 and 2009, when 1,400 Palestinians were killed, 930 or so of them were civilians, 330 or so were children. During that period, during the brief moments when the bombing stopped, when the rocket fire into Gaza stopped, when people looked out their window to see who was moving, what was happening, what they saw were U.S.-made, U.S.-financed F-16s dropping U.S.-made, U.S.-financed bombs, and U.S.-made and U.S.-financed Apache helicopters firing U.S.-made Tomahawk rockets, U.S.-made tear gas canisters, all of it made in USA. So why are we surprised when we see these polls year after year of the stature of the United States dropping around the world? Why are we surprised when those of us who travel a lot in the Middle East suddenly are having to watch our back much more than we ever did before? I was never afraid traveling in the Middle East, traveling alone as a woman. I never worried about it. But in recent years, it's a lot more dangerous. because people can't reach my government. They can reach me. I'm walking on the street, you know? So it doesn't keep us safer. And the good news is, I'll come back to the good news before I wrap up so we have time for conversation. The good news is the discourse on this issue, as I mentioned earlier, has changed massively. The discourse in the Jewish community, the rise of organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, like J Street, the change in discourse in the mainstream press. They talk about the issue differently. You can talk about Israeli apartheid, and people will say, well, why do you use that term? Rather than saying, how dare you, that's anti-Semitism. Now, some people may still say that, but far fewer do. People now are more curious. They're not instinctively prepared to defend everything Israel does, partly because we see so much more. You know, when Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982, the massacre of Sabra and Shatila that was carried out by Israeli-backed Palestinian phalangist militias that led to almost 2,000 people being killed in an orgy of killing that went on in the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila over a three-day period, it took days before the word filtered out. There was nobody on scene with a camera. There was nobody with a cell phone that could immediately tweet out the photographs and the video of what was going on. But now there is no secrets. There are no secrets. You know, when Israel tried to keep foreign journalists out of Gaza in Operation Cast Lead, they failed not only because a number of outlets, including Al Jazeera, have Gazan reporters who live in Gaza, who are based there and who were already there, but because everybody in Gaza has a cell phone. And whenever there was an hour of electricity available, it was the first thing people did was power up their phones so they could send out to the world the video, the photographs, the information of what was going on. Nothing was secret. That puts a greater responsibility on us. And I think that what we see is that organizations, for example, one of the organizations I work with, the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, which now has almost 400 member organizations, from tiny little committees working on a campus somewhere to huge church-based groups of 100,000 or a million people that are members of the U.S. campaign. The reason that those groups are flourishing is because the discourse has changed in the United States. And people want to say no to U.S. military aid to Israel, and they want to do something on their own. The global campaign for what's known as BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, which has come out of a call from Palestinian civil society organizations, trade unions, women's groups, not the political factions, not the PLO, not Hamas and Fatah and all of them, but people's organizations on the ground in the occupied territories, called on the people of the world to participate in an effort to bring nonviolent economic and social pressure to bear on Israel to make it stop violating international law. And it identifies, we want this to go on until Israel stops these three sets of violations. Not forever. This isn't about, you know, we're against Israel and for the Palestinians. This is for international law. So in the U.S., there's a huge campaign for BDS. One of the big targets is Caterpillar bulldozers, who are sent to Israel specially formulated. It's the D9 bulldozer is specially made to the specifications of the IDF so it can be armored and used as a weapon of war. It's used to demolish Palestinian homes. It was a D9 armored bulldozer driven by an Israeli soldier that ran over and killed Rachel Corrie, the young peace activist from Olympia, Washington, 10 years ago last month. We just commemorated the 10-year anniversary of her death. And there's a huge campaign on campuses to get campuses not to buy Caterpillar bulldozers and snow removal equipment when they buy new stuff, on university endowments to pull out their investments in Caterpillar, to pressure Caterpillar to cut its contract with the Israeli military. Now, in terms of what that's going to mean for Caterpillar's, you know, doings on Wall Street, it's a tiny little contract. It's a speck in their overall global whatever. So it's, for them, symbolic. But for us, this is not symbolic. This is real. This is what changing U.S. policy is all about. It's changing what our government does. It's changing what our corporations do. It's changing what we do as individuals. All of that needs to be changed. And I will leave you with this. The discourse change has been massive over the last decade. And it enables politicians to do things that they never imagined they could do. It was always thought to be political suicide for a politician, especially in Washington, especially in Congress, to criticize Israel. It just isn't anymore. AIPAC is still a powerful part of the lobby. The Jewish pro-Israel lobby is still very wealthy. But they no longer have votes to bring to the table. It used to be they came with money and they came with votes. But look what happened. In the elections of 2008 and 2012, the mainstream Jewish pro-Israel organizations all told their supporters, don't vote for Barack Obama. He's not sufficiently pro-Israeli. And instead, people said, you know what? That's not our most important issue. We're voting for Barack Obama because we think he'll be a better president. And 78% of American Jewish voters voted for Barack Hussein Obama. And the following year, that was in 2008, and in 2012, 69% voted for Barack Hussein Obama in the face of AIPAC and others saying, don't do it. So they still have the money. They can still threaten to fund your opponent if you don't toe the line on Israel. But they no longer bring their votes to the table because they no longer have influence in the Jewish community. Jews are finding that there's other issues that are just as important or more important. And that's especially true of young Jews. That's what they're really worried about. They're losing support. Organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace are picking up supporters at the expense of Israel. At the expense of AIPAC. That's who's, you know, where people are going. So my challenge is this. Our job, having changed this discourse with incredibly hard work over 10 years, a BDS campaign across the country focusing on Caterpillar and other corporations, a campaign to end U.S. military aid to Israel. But we have not yet figured out how to transform that discourse change, that change in the conversation, into a real change of policy. How do we pierce that White House bubble and convince people that it is no longer political suicide to challenge Israel, that you can do it and live to tell the tale, and you might even be reelected? We now have models in Congress to point to. Keith Ellison is one. Brian Baird is another. Betty McCollum is another. There's a number of people that can say, yeah, I criticized AIPAC. I refused to sign their letter because I thought it was not in the interests of my district and not in U.S. national interests. And that's more important to me than what Israel wants. That's our challenge. How do we change the conversation shift into a policy shift? It's going to be really hard work, but that's what we have ahead. Thank you.
Okay, so we will now open the time up for questions. Please speak clearly into the mic and state a little bit about yourself and your name. Is there anyone that would like to ask a question?
Aaron Young, I'm a mining engineering student. I was just wondering, why is it that the U.S. has traditionally supported Israel?
Very good question. It's a bit of a long answer, but the short version, I think, comes down to two words, the Cold War. The U.S. relationship with Israel obviously goes back to pre-state days. The U.S. supported the creation of Israel, had a very helpful relationship to it. But the so-called special relationship didn't start until 1967 with the 67 war. That's in the middle of the Cold War. The U.S. and the Soviets are challenging each other all over the world, and the Middle East is one of those real points of contention. Israel goes to war, occupies all these territories after just 6 days. The mythology is Israel trounced six Arab armies. Actually didn't. There were four of them didn't really fight, but okay, whatever. The Israeli military did pretty good, right? 6 days and they won the war. And the military in the U.S., the Pentagon looked at that and said, wow, these guys are good. We could do business with these people. And military business became the basis first of the special relationship. So the military industries in both countries started working together, and the militaries themselves, the IDF and the Pentagon, began this long process of collaboration where very quickly Israel became essentially a cat's paw of U.S. interests in the Cold War all around the world, not only in the Middle East, but in places like Nicaragua and El Salvador and Angola, Mozambique, South Africa, you know, the collaboration on nuclear weapons between Israel and apartheid South Africa goes back to that era. And Israel becomes essentially an instrument, a junior partner for the U.S. battle in the Cold War. In that context, the pro-Israel lobby, which has been around for years but was never all that popular, never that powerful, suddenly they're everybody's favorite guy in Washington because they're now pushing the U.S. to do what U.S. strategists and policymakers want to do anyway, build the relationship with Israel. So suddenly all of their work to influence the media, to influence school curriculum, to influence popular culture, all of that stuff, that suddenly takes off like nobody's business. And suddenly you see this long-standing interaction, intersection between the lobby, the political side, and the military, the strategic side, of what the U.S.-Israeli relationship is all about. And from then on, those two factors are almost impossible to disentangle. So when we get to the end of the Cold War, and suddenly the strategic value of Israel as a strategic ally is kind of on the skids, we don't really need it, and it's kind of a problem. You know, we've got this war, and we're about to go to war in Iraq, and we don't want Israel in there because it'll just make it more complicated. You still have the lobby being incredibly powerful because of this intersection. So that's the short version of what that, you know, what that special relationship is all about.
My name is Sean Harris, and I'm an IS and
political science major. Can you hold it a little closer? Thanks.
Is that better?
Yeah.
My name is Sean Harris, and I'm an IS and political science major. My question would be, when you mentioned that the discourse has changed regarding Israel and its policies, but when you go and you try to have a discussion and use numbers like you gave out as to how much Utah is putting in, you get a lot of blowback from people who disagree with you, even though you have numbers that prove it. So how do you change not only the discourse, but how do you get people to accept the facts that this is true?
Yeah. That's a hard question. I don't think you ever win over people with numbers. I think the numbers are useful as tools for figuring out things like, where are we supposed to get money for jobs? Why do we have no money for jobs? So my institute a few months ago just issued the latest edition of our report called We're Not Broke, that goes through all this myth that the U.S. has no money, to say we are so much the richest country in the world. We have so much money. It's just in the wrong places, being used for the wrong things and controlled by the wrong people. So we went through and found ways of finding money in three arenas, the areas where we do the most work. So one was on the question of taxation. So you tax the rich and corporations more fairly. On the environment, you stop government subsidies of fossil fuels, which makes us greener and cleaner as well as more just. And on the wars, you end wars and you cut the military budget. And by doing those three things without making us less safe, in fact making us more safe, more green, and more just, we were able to save $852 billion in 1 year, 10 times the amount the sequester called for, by identifying where are the real wrong places to spend money. When you do that, you suddenly have money for jobs and health care and education and all the things that are important to people. I think that you have to start where people are. It's an old adage of organizers that you don't start where you want people to be, you start with where they are. So if you're talking to somebody who you know is a very passionate supporter of Israel, whether or not they know a lot of facts or not, they're passionate about it. I don't think you're going to win over anybody by throwing a lot of numbers and statistics at them. It might work for students who are, you know, really committed to the facts, but that's rare. People are connected to Israel in ways that have little to do with facts, that have a lot to do with emotions, that have to do with religion, that have to do with family, that have to do with all kinds of things. People may think that it was the only thing that could happen after the Holocaust, and therefore anything it does is legitimate. People may think that the Jews are the chosen people and somehow should all have the right to go back there. The Christian Zionists, as you know, support, people may or may not know, their religious basis for their Zionism is based on the idea that before the second coming of Christ, all the Jews have to be gathered in one place in the Holy Land. And when they do, when they're all gathered there, then they either convert or die. Now, as a Jew, that's not exactly the choice I would like to have, but, you know, plenty of Jews will support getting support from Christian Zionists, and when you say to them, why do you support that, when they want to either have you convert or die, they say, ah, well, we know that's not really true. So people support Israel for all kinds of reasons, and you have to start with where they are. And facts are useful for that, but they're probably not enough. I would urge everybody who's interested in helping others to figure out the facts to first really learn the facts yourself. I'm sorry I don't have any copies left with me. I brought a bunch of copies but sold them all this morning, of a little primer that I've done called Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, which is done as it's a set of FAQs. And it's questions like, who are the Palestinians? Why are they in Israel? And like some of my Palestinian friends, when I wrote that, were like, how dare you? Why would you say, why are they in Israel? They're not in Israel. And I'm saying, yeah, but people ask the question, why are they in Israel? Here's an answer. You know, who is Yasser Arafat and why did he reject the Israelis' generous offer? You have an answer, you know. So I think that those kinds of facts, when you have them in your head, enable you to talk to people at a level that isn't just facts and statistics, but that also is about stories, is about people, is about options. You know, the horrors of anti-Semitism that not only led to the Holocaust, but the anti-Semitism that prevented Holocaust survivors from coming to the United States is a huge reason for the growth of Israel in that period. Because the majority of European Jewish survivors of the Holocaust didn't want to go to this new place in Palestine that wasn't a state yet. They wanted to come where their families were, which were overwhelmingly in New York and in the UK. Anti-Semitism and anti-communism in the United States, Jews were all assumed to be communists, were the reason they weren't allowed into the United States. And as a result, people said, okay, then we're going to go to this new place and build this state, and became very committed to and attached to, and that's perfectly understandable. But it also means that there were other reasons why people created Israel in the way that it did, identifying as a Jewish state in the way that it is. So understanding that history, I think, helps us to help other people figure out what other ways they might look at things. The bottom line, and I'll end with this, is to come back to the question of international law. Because there you're talking about everybody's rights. And nobody is saying that the Israelis, the Israeli Jews, need to leave. Israel, as tiny as it is, has a ton of vacant land. And they have shown themselves brilliant at how to build new housing and integrate new immigrants really fast. 1 million new immigrants, a 20% rise in the population in 1 year, in 1991, from Russia, with the fall of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And Israel absorbed them brilliantly. They are brilliant at absorption. So the notion that the right of return, for instance, inevitably means we're going to be killed or we're going to be destroyed or we're going to lose something simply doesn't add up to what Israel has proved itself able to do.
I'm Barbara Taylor, and I'm a concerned senior citizen. During the 2008 election, people had great hope for Obama, partly because he attended a church in Chicago where the pastor seemed to understand the Palestinian problem. And I'm wondering what happened. Maybe he really does understand the problem. And I'm also wondering if there are any people like you with your vision who are advising Obama.
Well, the second one's easier to answer, no. There were people in Obama's team early on who, one is Robert Malley, who was in the National Security Council under Clinton, and was one of the top advisors to Clinton during the Camp David negotiations that allegedly came very close. And he has since written an incredible book sort of saying what actually happened in that period. He was one of Obama's advisors in the first campaign, and he works for the International Crisis Group. When his name was mentioned as, oh, well, he's known as a, whatever it was called, a critic of Israel or something, he was dropped like a hot potato. Obama is an old personal friend of Rashid Khalidi, who I just mentioned has written this brilliant new book on U.S. policy and towards the Middle East. Their kids knew each other in Chicago. They were, you know, he was never consulted. Now, we do know that Obama has had dinner with Edward Said, something that no one goes away from unchanged. But I think the best way to understand it is the way a friend of mine once described it. There are really three Barack Obamas, and we conflate them at our peril. Barack Obama, the man, understands issues of race and class and prejudice and community organizing and Palestine. But it sort of doesn't matter because that's not the president. Barack Obama, the candidate, ran as a kind of center-left, mainstream Democratic candidate who really wanted to win. President Barack Obama is governing center-right, hoping that he can win massive Republican support if he just moves far enough to the right. He hasn't won over the Republicans, but his bitterest opponents politically are the left wing of his own party rather than the opposing party. That's who we're dealing with as president. So all the stuff about doesn't he remember is painful for all of us, but ultimately doesn't really matter. That's not who sits in the White House.
We have time for one final question.
One more question.
My name is Jefferson. I'm a student here at the university. And my question is, you started out your discussion talking about the title of it, how we talk about peace in the Holy Land, and how we often look at it as a religious issue. You mentioned as well that you are Jewish. And so I'm wondering, I know this is a pretty broad question, but how can we put aside those differences in terms of how we look at it in religion to look at it broadly from a human rights issue?
Great question. I think I have 2 minutes left, and I'll answer it really fast. The answer is, you started to say it yourself, human rights and international law. So everybody has the right to access the holy places to them. Everybody has the right to pray, to go to the mosque, which today, despite all the propaganda, Palestinians do not have the right, overwhelmingly, to pray either in Jerusalem, at the mosques, at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, to go to Bethlehem if they live in Jerusalem. There is no right of religious practice for Palestinians. And for Israeli Jews, there is, and that's a huge problem. But I think the way to deal with it is to say we govern on the basis of international law and human rights and equality. That includes equality of all religions and for those who have no religion. So those who don't practice any religion should have no fewer rights than those who do. Whatever rights I might have as a visitor or if I wanted to move to Israel should not be based on what religion I am. They should be equal to everybody. The fact that I enjoy what is known as the law of return, which says that every Jew anywhere in the world has the right to go to Israel, step foot off the plane at the airport, and get instant citizenship. Now, they may make a few exceptions for a few Jews around the way, but basically that's the law of return. Palestinians who under international law have the right of return are not even allowed to go to visit. People who have the key to their own house, who fled less than a generation ago, they're still alive. You know, that's the unfairness of it. So the religious part should be a right. It's a human right to practice one's religion or to practice no religion. It should not be the basis on which people gain rights. Rights should be equal. And if we had equal rights for all, the issue of religious practice would simply not be an issue. Thank you all.